Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a look inside the efforts to identify the root causes of violence among high school and college students, and what is and is not okay for sports fans to yell at opposing players. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Grijalva means established and present and here and ready to listen. And that's what we've done our entire lives. That's what I've done my entire adult life. And I am really proud to represent this community.
It is unlawful for President Trump to hold up this education funding and to wreak absolute havoc on our schools and on our students and families.
I feel like I can do a much better job than a federal Department of Education. I have 600 people working for me who know Arizona schools backwards and forwards, and that many of them have been doing it for many years.
The whole Western United States has seen this problem. Now, I'm more apt to say, listen, if you've had thinning processes in an area, you're going to let it simmer, but not until then. And this place had none of the such.
Unfortunately, my Republican colleagues are pushing for cuts that will make our country ultimately poorer, less educated, and less safe.
Today's recall effort is rooted in misrepresentation, divisive tactics, and do not reflect our democratic values. This effort is not about strength of the party. It's about distraction and dividing us at a time when unity is more important than ever.
And joining me to talk about a change atop the state Democratic Party, results from this week's primaries in the 7th Congressional District and more, are Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Good morning, Barrett.
Good morning.
And Mike Hayner of Lumen Strategies. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Mike, let me start with you on CD7. This is the primary race to replace the late Congressman Raul Grijalva. On the Democratic side, his daughter, Adelita Grijalva, won. On the Republican side, Daniel Gutierrez was the winner. There had been some talk about maybe Deja Fox, who's a social media influencer with a little bit of political background, maybe having a chance to win that primary. Ultimately, Grijalva won that by, I think, 40-some-odd points. Was the margin surprising to you?
A little bit. The Grijalva name obviously has been on a ballot in southern Arizona for 40 years.
Yeah.
And so I think the campaigns over the years, the get-out-the-vote efforts, all of the things that Congressman Grijalva had done and his daughter had done led to this victory. And it was by a very significant margin.
Barrett, does the margin surprise you at all, Barrett?
Yeah, they don't call it the Grijalva machine for nothing. The margin did a little bit surprise me. I don't think I bought into the national media's obsession with Deja Fox. I think probably a lot of her followers, supporters, in fact, the vast, vast majority of them don't live anywhere near CD7. They live in Minnesota and maybe Brooklyn, New York, but not CD7. So she certainly raised a lot of money, certainly got a high profile, but that did not in any way turn the votes for her.
I want to ask Mike also about Daniel Hernandez, who came in third, but also came into this race. I am not in that district, but he seems like he would have maybe the second highest name ID. I mean, the Hernandez name in southern Arizona, they've been involved in politics for a while. He's been in the legislature. He ran for Congress before. He came in a distant third in this race.
Yeah. Again, it's difficult because legislative races are so small and so targeted to a very few number of voters that when you expand outside that realm, it becomes much more difficult and your name ID isn't what you expect it to be. Mm-hmm. Even if you've run for Congress in a district similar to that a number of years ago, it just doesn't translate. And the memory of voters to say, oh, I remember that name from this district or from this race a couple of years ago, it's very difficult because people are trying to just live their lives.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, even your learned and scholarly listeners, many of them would be hard-pressed to figure out who their legislator was. They could probably tell you who their congressman is, but many, not all, but many would be hard-pressed to tell you who their legislator was. And I just, you know, I think the name Grijalva has rung out since, you know, you were in short pants. And so, you know, I just, it was too much of a hill to climb for just about anybody, but, you know, certainly a former state legislator.
So, Barrett, given the margin of Grijalva's victory here, and of course, this is a special election. She'll have to run again, assuming that she wins in the fall, which she should
know.
Because it's a pretty Democratic district.
Trump is really going to work hard on this one.
I mean, given the margin, would you imagine that sort of maybe insulates her from a primary challenge next year when she has to run for the full term?
I can't imagine anyone serious taking her on. That would be a fool's errand.
Would you agree with that, Mike?
100%. I mean, there may be some gadfly that decides to, you know, this is my time, but she's going to win re-election after she wins election in the fall.
I mean, this is going to be a Grijalva seat for maybe three generations, you know, 2 to 3 generations, easy.
Yep.
Mike, I want to ask you about sort of the using this race, because Barrett brought up all the national attention and, you know, there were comparisons between Deja Fox and AOC and Mamdani in New York. There, you know, is this the future of the Democratic Party? It seemed like on policy, both Grijalva and Fox are fairly progressive. They both call themselves progressive. Their policies, it didn't seem like there was an awful lot of daylight between them. I wonder if there's anything to be said about what this race and the results on the Democratic side mean for the Democratic Party. Or is it just this is somebody who everybody in that district knows? Her father held the seat forever. And as we heard her say, all politics is local.
That's 100% correct. All politics is local. The family's been in that district for, like I said, more than 40 years, from supervisors' races to school board races to city races. And this has nothing to do with national politics in any way, shape, or form. This is District 7 in Tucson, and you can end it there.
Yeah, I do absolutely agree with that. I don't think there's any lesson to be learned from the CD7 race this year, because it just really was a look at the Grijalva name.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. So, Mike, let me ask you about another election that took place this week. This one just among Democrats, and it was to oust the party chair, Robert Branscombe, who was just elected in a landslide to that post about 6 months ago. It was not a smooth tenure for Mr. Branscombe atop the state Democratic Party. I'm curious, you know, what you make of sort of all the machinations and ultimately the vote to oust him.
I don't think it really means anything. The average voter in Arizona, Democrat, Republican, Independent, Green, Libertarian, whatever you want to be, probably couldn't tell you who the chair of their party is or what their actual structure of the party does. They vote for candidates. We've seen this in the Republican side with them bypassing the state party and going to Yuma a number of years ago. Doug Ducey won election handily when that happened. It's irrelevant in the big scheme of things who the party chair is. It's all about the behind the scenes, you know, raising money and all that other stuff that matters. And the next person needs to be able to do that type of stuff.
You know, one thing I'm a little jealous of, Democrats, you know, nipped this in a bud, you know, 6 months, right? Whereas when there was all this mishigas with the state Republican Party, we were ride or die with Kelly Ward until we, you know, went off the cliff. And so at least they nipped it in the bud, and, you know, now maybe they'll get, you know, someone with a heartbeat into that position. I don't know. No one really wants it, it seems.
Well, that seems to be the issue, right, Mike? Like, nobody, like, who would want this job? They're going to be walking into what seems like a pretty messy situation.
Well, again, all you need to do is have the backing of the elected officials, you know, have the correct staff, and this job isn't that difficult. So, but again, in the world of politics today, how many people actually want to be involved in any of it?
Absolutely not. But I absolutely agree with Mike, nobody knows who the party chairman is in the public. Hmm. This is all about sort of the grassroots, but also, you know, parties are supposed to raise money and register voters. So far, Democrats have not been able to do that over the last couple of years. I mean, they're a huge deficit on voter registration.
Definitely a huge voter registration issue. But from a raising money standpoint, yeah. Obviously, they competed well financially in the last cycle. Results weren't as great. You know, obviously, Senator Gallego won. Mm-hmm. They lost a couple of seats at the legislature. But it was nowhere near as bad as it could have been. And again, I think the money is going to be fine. It's the voter registration issue that's problematic.
But the money doesn't seem to be fine now, though.
Right. And that's a great rallying cry. You know, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. the Democratic Party finances are bad, but I think the money will be there, whether it's Navajo County, the state Democratic Party. Again, to Mike's point earlier, you know, Doug Ducey and, for that matter, John McCain, when they each diverted money to the Yuma County Party, the Yuma County Republican Party did a great job, and they were the richest, you know, county party in the entire country, right? They were just getting funneled millions of dollars, and they were doing the work of the state Republican Party. So did people in Kingman go, gee, why is Yuma County, you know, Republican Party messaging to me? No, they didn't. And so it really doesn't matter the structure, you know, it just is a little, I mean, it's Michigas, and right. we in the political world love it, but in the real world, it's
nobody cares.
Well, so Barrett, I guess then if you are a Republican candidate for one of the statewide offices, is this the kind of thing where you look at it and maybe you think, okay, like the Democratic Party is kind of going through some stuff right now. But as you say, when Ducey and McCain went through Yuma, they still won. So maybe, like, if you're the Republicans, don't let this be a distraction. Don't take your foot off the gas just because the Democrats are going through Navajo County instead of the state party.
Right. And, you know, look, it's messaging, right? It's, you know, what are Democrats standing for and what are Republicans standing for? And that is what will win elections, not who the party chairman is or what, you know, structure it is. It is the messaging. And right now, Democrats don't have great messaging. And, you know, we're going to see, I mean, it's a year and a half till the next election. I mean, that is a lifetime. Lord only knows what'll happen. But right now, you know, Republicans are winning on the messaging side.
Well, and again, I think you're right. The messaging matters, but also the economy matters. Mm-hmm. And as we start to see some of the effects of the tariff, some of the effects of cuts, you know, some of the things that are happening kind of underground in the economy, you know, that's also going to play a large role into what the messaging actually is.
Sure.
And I think that's going to have a great influence on the outcome of the 2026.
Yeah, I don't think there was two things that drove 2024, the economy and then illegal immigration. And Trump has done well on illegal, you know, stanching the flow of border crossers. And then obviously everyone can argue about sort of the interior enforcement, but it's the economy, you know, Trump really does have to watch it. That, and of course, Epstein.
All these years later, still the economy, stupid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
Barrett, let me ask you about a bipartisan call in Arizona for an investigation into the Dragon Bravo fire. This is on the north rim of the Grand Canyon, of course, burned down the historic Grand Canyon Lodge. There, a lot of folks are pretty upset about it. Started by lightning, was allowed to continue sort of as a controlled burn, and then the winds shifted and it kind of lost control, and now the North Rim is closed for the rest of the season. Is this the kind of thing that you would expect to have a bipartisan call? It's not just Democrats accusing the Trump administration messing up here. You hear people like Congressman Paul Gosar saying, we need to look into this.
This is, you know, environmentalism or nature, and by the way, I am an avid indoorsman. I don't really do nature, but this is an area where it really brings together the tree-hugging hippies with the gun-toting hunters. You know, they all want their open space, places to go hunting and camping. Ugh, sounds horrible. I know. I hate to give your listeners that horrible impression. But, you know, they all want to go hunting and camping and everything like that. So nature does actually bring together. So I'm not surprised at all that both Hobbs and Gosar are on the same side of this issue.
Well, Mike, it seems especially when it comes to the Grand Canyon, that seems to be the one thing that kind of brings the state together politically, right? Like, if the Grand Canyon is going to be closed for some reason, like, people on both parties, on both sides of the aisle are saying, we got to open it up. We got to protect it.
Yeah, but I would argue Governor Hobbs led this charge, right? She was the first one to call for an investigation. She was the first one to point out the fact that there seemed to be some inconsistency in how they managed this fire. Mm-hmm. But it is shocking to me that we have bipartisan support for an investigation and looking into this, because bipartisanship is not normal anymore. Like, we've gone so far that again, it's surprising to me that both parties or elected officials of both parties would say, yeah, this is a problem and we need to look into it.
Barrett, is it worth noting that someone like Congressman Gosar, who is among the furthest to the right members of Congress, I think it's safe to say, I think he would probably say that, is looking to investigate something to do with the Trump administration?
Yeah. Look, I think he's already blamed Biden for this.
He has.
Yeah. It's, and so.
Oddly.
Yeah. I'm sure Obama had something to do with it as well. And so he's coming at it a little bit differently. And facts really don't matter anyway. But he is, I'm sure, just as angry as, say, Governor Hobbs. And he sees it, I'm sure he'll see the outcome much differently than other people. But he does have to look like he's calling for action. Because again, his people, right? His people care about what happened up there. And he cannot ignore it. Neither he nor Eli Crane, or they can ignore, you know, what's going on, you know, with these fires. I mean, look, we're in fire. We've sort of coming out of fire season. And that, you know, fire burns both Republican homes and Democratic homes.
Well, and Mike, one of the things we've heard already, and of course, we don't really know, they haven't done the investigation yet, but, you know, there are, especially on the left, people are saying, you know, well, this is Doge, right? They went in and they eliminated a bunch of jobs and they cut a bunch of funding, and, you know, the Forest Service and the wildland firefighters, they just don't have enough resources, not enough people, not enough whatever it is that they need. I wonder if this becomes the kind of issue where people who are opposed to that kind of thing will say, look, you might want to cut spending in the abstract, but here's how it really impacts people's lives. Here's how it impacts, you know, our state.
Definitely. Again, part of the challenge is when you just randomly eliminate positions and eliminate jobs, programs, without looking at What are they actually doing, and how are they actually benefiting the states or the federal government or the Arizona U.S. taxpayer? Like, these cuts related to we've never had enough wildland firefighters. We always struggle with that type. That's why I think Governor Ducey had that corrections program that allowed you know, inmates to become wildland firefighters. So it's always a challenge. And when you just randomly cut things without thinking about how it impacts the world, that does become a problem.
Yeah. Doge, you know, I think a lot of people were, you know, supportive of the concept, the high level concept of reducing government. I think just, you know, firing FAA people, inspectors and, you know, health inspectors and, you know, just getting rid of whole, you know, swaths of people without actually realizing what they do, and then having to recall them back. And I think that was a mistake. They really did miss an opportunity to go in and break things, but break them in a responsible way. And to get rid of, you know, NOAA, you know,
the Weather Service folks
and things like that. I mean, we may see some consequences to that.
All right. So, Barrett, going from the Grand Canyon to the Southeast Valley now, we saw this week, that's a interesting transition.
Yeah.
We saw this week that the mayor of Chandler, Kevin Harkey, has filed a statement of interest to run for the legislature in one of the more competitive seats in the state. The incumbent, J.D. Mesnard, is termed out. One of the state representatives is running for the Senate. I'm curious what you make of sort of this musical chairs of, you know, Mike said, who wants to get into public life anymore? Apparently, the Chandler mayor wants to be a state legislator.
Well, yeah. Look, the you know, the retirement benefits are pretty good. And you know, you get, you know, jack up your years of service there. Look, this is a very
competitive. Taking a big pay cut, though.
Well, no, because it's your highest. So, you know, he still gets to retain that. This is one of the most competitive districts. And, you know, Harkey is a pretty, you know, liberal Republican. And I think he would do very well if he can get out of the primary. If a couple of conservatives are in there and challenging him, he may not be able to get out of the primary. And that would be the problem. But he's a very attractive general election.
Does this seem like sort of a good get for state Republicans to get somebody who has name ID? We talked about nobody knows who their legislator is. I would think a lot of people in the Chandler area know who their mayor is. Maybe?
Yeah.
No?
I think so.
Sure.
Yeah.
Why not? when they're bored, they watch, you know, the local, you know, Cox at, you know, 2 a.m, they can't sleep. They put on the city council. Sure. You know, that happens a lot, really.
Do you see this as a good get for Republicans, Mike?
It is, but it's also, a shock to city elected officials when they come to the legislature.
Mm. Oh, for sure.
The whole world is different. In the city, you have a city manager. You have all of this professional staff that has been there for years and years and years. And in the legislature, you don't have that. You might have 12 new employees because there's a new speaker or a new president. All of that changes. So the timing of everything, cities are, you know, they plan, they think about it, they do study sessions. The legislature doesn't do any of that. The legislature moves forward with 1,500 bills every year, regardless. And it's sometimes a shock to city folks who come over to the legislature.
Yeah, and you know, they're used to doing, quite frankly, right? I mean, cities do stuff and well, the legislature doesn't do much. And, you know, there's no, you know, it's not necessarily common sense or what works best. It's, you know, what you're hearing at your LD meetings is, you know, what runs policy down there. So it is a big difference. And which is why you don't see a ton of city people anymore move. It used to be, you know, you would get that.
Sure.
Right? I mean, I think about, you know, the J. Tip Shraneys of the
right.
world.
And Harry Mitchell.
You know. But that doesn't happen much anymore because who wants to deal with, you know, 89 other knuckleheads?
Well, on that happy note, we'll have to leave it there. Barrett Marson, Mike Hayner, neither of you are knuckleheads. Thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, heckling is pretty common at sporting events, but what happens when someone takes it too far? But first, Brett Steele has devoted much of her career to studying the root causes of violence. Her work takes many forms. She served on federal anti-violence task forces, advised states on preventing violence in schools, and curated workshops and resource guides for educators and clinicians. She spent many years at the McCain Institute as Senior Director of Preventing Targeted Violence and currently serves as the president of the Eradicate Hate Global Summit. As a result of this, she keeps a close eye on the most innovative efforts to identify and prevent people and environments that are likely to foster violence. She recently studied the results of a program designed to identify the root causes of violence among high school and college students. The participants in the program told facilitators that the thing that scares them the most amongst their fellow students is misogyny, in particular, the so-called incel phenomenon, young men who consider themselves to be involuntarily celibate and who tend to harbor feelings of hate and outrage towards women. As a follow-up, student groups at Missouri State and ASU workshop ways of counteracting these perceptions, trying to identify and connect with men who might unwittingly already be on a dangerous path. Steele was intrigued by the project, and she spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman more about it.
At Missouri State University, they said, we want to address the risk factors for violence well before. Mm-hmm. There's any real risk of violent action. And so those students developed a curriculum for third, fourth, and fifth grade students. At Arizona State University, they focused instead on high school students. And they said, we want to identify the students who are alienated, who are disconnected. And we want to design a survey that will identify students on campus who don't feel connected to campus, don't feel like there are any clubs or faculty who speak to them, and ask them what their interests are in a confidential manner so that the school could design activities to reach some of the students that were previously unreachable.
Wow, that's fascinating.
One of the things that research has shown us time and time again is when youth, and it often unfortunately is young men, turn to violence, oftentimes there is that alienation, that isolation, that sense of grievance, and a real disconnectedness.
Yeah. So what did the focusing on the ASU students for the moment who did this outreach, what did they find that these, it sounds like primarily men that they were identifying, were interested in, and what steps did they take?
So in the pilot they ran, I believe one of their findings was an interest in gaming and recognizing that gaming doesn't have to be antisocial. There are lots of ways that gaming can be pro-social. You can build communities around games. And so they use the example of how can we provide a positive space and a positive way to engage students who may be playing some of the same games, and create a club around that. In the high schools, several of the administrators they engaged with said they had not asked this question of students previously.
I see.
And so they thought it was a novel concept that these university students came up with to go to the students themselves and say, you know, are you feeling isolated? What interests you?
Wow. Wow. I mean, that seems quietly profound, you know, this idea of like, instead of treating this constituency of folks, instead of just identifying them as the problem group, approaching them and saying, what are you into? Like, we're interested in you.
Right. There's another profound question that you can ask, which is, do you have a trusted adult? One of the greatest protective factors, so something that makes violence less likely, is having an adult you trust who you can go to. And unfortunately, in many cases, students don't feel like they have a trusted adult. And so looking at ways to ask students if they have someone and encourage students to find someone and encourage adults on campuses to want to serve that role and be willing to serve that role as well.
Interesting. And so is the idea there that you want to kind of create a space where there's an adult in somebody's life who might not be there otherwise, to whom they could come if they're having strong feelings about something that might otherwise lead to violence? Instead, they feel like there's somebody they can talk to and say, I'm upset about this thing, or I'm angry about this thing.
That may be the case. Another alternative example is if you're concerned about one of your friends.
Yeah.
And you don't know what to do about it. So whatever you're concerned about, or maybe you're really frustrated with your parents, you know, there can be any number of things that can cause genuine concern and angst in a student's mind. And having someone they can turn to, having a trusted adult to be able to talk things through with, can really provide some grounding.
Yeah.
And a sense that you're not in it alone.
Right, right. Well, Brett, in closing, you were asked at the conclusion of last year's Eradicate Hate Summit, what your takeaway was. I'm curious why you said hope.
The reason why I have hope is because these acts of hate-fueled violence are preventable. We've seen time and time again concrete examples of people recognizing warning signs and seeking help and getting help early enough that we could really change the outcome for these often young, often men, who were at risk of committing acts of violence. It takes everyone to effectively prevent this type of violence. Everyone has a role to play, but it is preventable, and we can all work together to make that happen.
Well, Brett Steele is president of the Eradicate Hate Global Summit. Brett, thank you so much for this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The Diamondbacks host the St. Louis Cardinals tonight at Chase Field in their first game after the All-Star break. But it was an incident at a baseball game in Chicago last month that got the attention of the sports world, and not in a good way. Diamondbacks second baseman Ketel Marte was seen in tears on the field during a game against the White Sox. We later learned Marte had heard a fan yell at him about his mother, who had died in a car accident in the Dominican Republic several years ago. MLB banned the fan from all ballparks the following day. After the game, D-backs manager Torrey Lovello said it was a terrible moment and that sometimes fans go too far.
At the end of the day, we're human beings and we have emotions, and I saw him hurting and I want to protect him. I love you and I'm with you and we're all together and you're not alone. No matter what happens, no matter what was said or what you heard, that guy's an idiot.
When my next guest saw the video of what happened, as a sports fan, he says he was sad for the player and the world of sports. Daniel Wan says it's obvious Marte's response was real and intense, which shows how damaging the fan's comment had been. Wan is a distinguished professor of psychology at Murray State University, where he studied the psychology of sports fans for about four decades. He says as an academic, he felt disgusted. Even though incidents like these are rare, he says, even one is too many. When I spoke with him about this earlier, I asked if this kind of thing, though, is becoming less rare these days.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if we had those statistics? But they really don't exist, and I'll tell you why. Everybody's been to a sporting event where somebody in the stands has yelled something that probably crossed the line. No one's sitting there with a counter in their hand. Are the numbers going up? Well, I mean, I think those of us in the academic world would probably argue that they are, for reasons such as a society, we're less civil than we used to be. Well, if society is less civil, why wouldn't sports fans be less civil? So if it seems like it's happening more often, there's theoretical reasons as to why that is probably the case.
What is the line between, for example, booing for the team that your team is playing against and not going too far? Is it just a matter of, for example, like rooting against the team and not rooting against or yelling things at individual players?
That's such a great question. And I really do think that there's no clear answer to that question. And it does break down based on perhaps the age of the athlete, the competition level. So for example, I think that most individuals would take the stance that booing a ref's decision or the opposing players, not getting personal, just booing, is probably okay. And, you know, within the confines of sporting events, well, okay. Is that actually true if it's a Little League baseball game? Probably not.
Yeah.
So, you know, we do have sort of qualifiers here. I think the moment that you say something that is personal and that you would be upset if you were said that, or if a friend was said that it was said to them, I think that, you know, at that point, you've probably crossed the line. If you say anything threatening, are you saying something that you would not want your child to hear? Then you're probably saying something that shouldn't be said.
So I wonder, though, like, because, you know, a lot of fans will say that part of their quote unquote job at a game is to rattle the other team, rattle the visiting team. So, like, is it considered okay to point out a player's flaws in the game? You know, if a player has a bad batting average, for example, is it okay to say, hey, you know, you're a terrible hitter? I mean, I'm sure a fan would say something far more creative than that, as opposed to saying something about them as a human being or about their family or something like that.
I think that's where you draw the line, right? So if a player is struggling, you know, fans are going to remind the player that, hey, you haven't had a hit in 2 weeks or something. And I think that the players, they're like, okay, that's a part of my job, and my job is in the public eye. So, you know, that kind of stuff is fair game. The second it becomes personal, The second becomes vulgar. The second it becomes threatening. That's, again, where I think the line has to get drawn. You can't say things to players that you wouldn't feel comfortable saying to somebody else, like in your family or somebody else on the street. That's just not appropriate. It unfortunately becomes a part of these spectacles, but that doesn't make it okay.
I have to ask about the impact you think that alcohol plays into this, because pretty much any sporting event you go to, there's a lot of beer.
Yeah, anybody who thinks that alcohol doesn't play a role in this is really kidding themselves. You know, this is one of those topics when I discuss it in my class, it's under the category of the goodness, how many studies do we have to do, right? I mean, how much data do we have yeah. before people understand that, you know, it's a complicated relationship, but at the end of the day, alcohol has the ability to facilitate aggression and you know, overly assertive responses and things like that. And if we think that alcohol doesn't matter, I mean, that's when you say as a scientist, well, if I can't get you to buy into that, pretty much nothing else I'm going to say is really going to matter, right? If you can't, you know, get on board with the obvious things, then after that, you know, we're just going to have a hard time getting along at all.
Sure. I want to ask you about different sports, because the situation with Ketel Marte obviously happened at a baseball stadium, but there are other sports where fans and players are much closer together in proximity. You know, I think about at many NBA arenas where there are basically fans sitting on or right next to the bench or right behind the bench. The access to players seems much greater. Do you see, and again, understanding there are no real statistics on this, but are some sports maybe more subjected to this than others?
Well, I think that certainly every sport has had its unfortunate instance of these things happening. The one thing I will say about baseball is that relative to hockey and to football and to basketball, there is, quite frankly, a lot of downtime. But this is still time where the players are on the field. Think about the minute and a half, the 2 minutes in between innings. Mm-hmm. The players in the outfield are you know, playing catch and loosening up their arms. The crowd is not into the game, so to speak. There's not a whole lot going on. So things can be said that can be heard. That's a long time and plenty of opportunity for fans to say things that they shouldn't say. Think about a basketball game. Yeah, there are some timeouts that occur, but by and large, they're fewer and further between. And, you know, the organs are playing, these inside stadiums are louder, and the sound is resonating. It's easier at a baseball game for a fan to pick a time to yell out to a player who's on the field and get that player's attention.
You alluded to the reaction, in this case, of Ketel Marte of the Diamondbacks, but I want to ask you more broadly about how players are responding to this. And I wonder if there's maybe a generational thing happening, because, you know, you hear a lot of, I hate to use this phrase, old-time baseball players, because they were playing when I was a kid, who are now, you know, broadcasters or retired. But they'll talk about, especially pitchers, for example, you hear, you know, them talk about the kinds of things that they heard yelled at them when they were warming up in the bullpen, and they kind of laugh it off and joke about some of the horrible things that people said to them. Are you seeing a change in players sort of, in some way, maybe being allowed to respond more genuinely, like Ketel Marte did, to what's being yelled at them, and it being seen as less okay by other fans and maybe even the teams themselves that fans say these kinds of things to the players?
I hope so, right? I hope that one thing that might come out of this is that players begin to realize, if they haven't already, that, you know what, these things, not only are they off limits and inappropriate, they also shouldn't happen. So that those are two different things, right? It's one thing to say, well, I can't believe that a fan would yell that, but it's a part of being a professional athlete. It's different to say, well, I can't believe the fan yelled that, and I want that fan gone and banned for life. And I have to hope that that's where we're headed with this. So I'm hoping that, you know, if anything is to come from this that would be a positive side, would be that the leagues and the players are like, okay, look, you know, we get that things are going to be said, but there has to be things that we all can acknowledge are beyond the bounds of what is acceptable.
All right. That is Daniel Wan, a distinguished professor of psychology at Murray State University. Daniel, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Heat-related deaths are becoming a fact of life in the Valley of the Sun as our summer heat becomes more extreme and deadly. Last summer was the hottest on record, but despite the unrelenting temperatures, Maricopa County reported fewer heat-related deaths than the year before, and they attributed it largely to giving people more places to cool off. The city expanded hours at cooling centers across the valley, including overnight hours at some locations. My co-host Lauren Gilger visited one of them last summer, a 24-hour site at Burton Bar Library in downtown Phoenix, where demand was huge.
I mean, it's saving hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of lives this summer. We've never seen a 24-hour heat respite open like this before, and we are seeing people come in droves. They're coming from all over the city of Phoenix, hearing that they can access our services.
That's Caroline Fawn, homeless liaison with the city of Phoenix. She's been in the cooling center 7 days a week throughout this summer.
We have people coming here for everything to utilize services. We get people into shelters. We connect them with crisis. We get them to the emergency room when they need. Really, we've kind of just shaped into whatever anybody needs right now.
They've had 14,000 visits to these extended hour sites so far this summer, and more than 400 people who they say have accepted services at them. And Fawn told me they're reaching people of all kinds.
We do see a lot of families come in that are homeless, and we have been able to get them a direct access to family shelter, which has been great to see.
And that's tough. So kids coming in?
Yeah, absolutely. Families that are facing homelessness come in to us. We usually see one every 2 days, and they come in and we direct them to services and we get them off the streets.
The City of Phoenix's Director of Homeless Solutions, Rachel Milne, gave me a tour of the operation. From their new air-conditioned shipping container in the parking lot called the Cooltainer to the crowded former cafe they've converted into a cooling center inside.
Oh, wow, it is really crowded in here today, yeah.
As you walk into the cooling center at Burton Bar, you see piles of stuff waiting outside. Bikes, suitcases, bags. There are security guards outside and inside the doors, wanding people who come in. Inside, people check in at an intake desk manned by Community Bridges staff. People sit in chairs throughout the small room, chatting, resting, charging their phones. There are ASU nursing students circulating among them, checking people's vitals.
So this is the only 24-hour cooling center site in the city, which is important. I mean, obviously, there are shelters where folks can go. Talk about the difference. Like, why keep them open 24 hours? Were we running out of shelter space when it is still staying so hot at night?
So shelter capacity has been an issue the last several years in our community. Proud to say the city's been really focused on increasing that shelter capacity. Last week we opened up a 140-bed shelter, so that is a concern, but also shelter is not for everyone. So this not only is a place where people can come in from the heat, get a bottle of water, sit down, talk to someone, but also a place where they can get transportation and immediate placement into a shelter space, our safe outdoor space. Several people have gone to treatment or other services from these locations.
Wow, so it's an opportunity, it sounds like, for you in that way. Talk about capacity. I mean, I know the city expanded the number of places that people could go this summer, and there is a 24-hour one here we are now. But is it enough? Like, are you over capacity? Are you turning people away?
So we did feel a few weeks ago that we needed additional capacity, which is why we added the Cooltainer to our site. But we have always been sort of, like, focused on the fact that we're offering additional new shelters. So really, those are excellent places for us to have to be able to refer people to who might not have an indoor place to go this summer.
What do you know about how the message got out to people in the community here? Like, how did you get the message out and try to tell people, this is a place you can go, don't stay on the street in the middle of the day, you're going to get hurt?
Yeah, we worked with our communications team to do a huge marketing campaign. I've seen the billboards around. We've let outreach teams know. We've also just tried to make it a big effort, not only for people experiencing homelessness, but for others in need. This isn't just for one type of population. It's really meant for anyone in the community who needs it, so that anyone whose air conditioning might go out, who doesn't have air conditioning, knows that these sites are available to them.
Let me ask you about policing this. There's security, as we mentioned. I know one of the issues in shelters is drug use and trying to make sure that that stays out of the shelters. Is that something you're able to police?
So this site does have rules. We allow anyone to come in and cool off. The whole purpose of this site is to cool people down. We do wand people. We don't allow weapons. We don't allow drug use in this site. It certainly has rules we expect people to abide by. However, we're the lowest barrier entry. We want anyone to come in. The whole purpose of this site is to keep people from dying on the street due to heat.
Do you feel a lot of pressure, though, being sort of at the forefront of this and trying to figure out how to handle this in a way that many cities really have never had to do?
Well, yes. I just think our community was under a lot of pressure to do better this year. No one ever wants to see the number of heat-related deaths that we had last year. Our city definitely doesn't want to see the number of heat-related emergency calls that we had last year. So taking these proactive steps is going to prove, I think, to be very beneficial when we look at all the data at the end of the summer.
So, I mean, what if at the end of the summer we do see those heat death numbers go up again? What else do you think you can do?
I think the city will take a look at that data and learn, change, and improve for next year, certainly, as we're doing sort of midsummer right now, you know, adding capacity where we need to, adjusting security levels, adjusting navigation levels, bringing in additional partners, such as the ASU nursing students you see today. I think we're constantly making adjustments, and we'll continue to do that for next year as well.
Okay, thank you very much, Rachel Milne. I really appreciate your time and for showing me around here.
Thank you for coming. I appreciate you.
Milne talked a lot about the changing approach the city of Phoenix is taking to addressing the heat and homelessness this summer and how much they want this center to be low barrier. Pets are allowed. You can sleep here if you want to and no one will bother you. But around the back of the library, there were still groups of people sitting around that day, napping, chatting, smoking in the heat. Autumn Williams was there. She told me she's used the cooling centers many times, especially at night, but there are still barriers for some.
Not that they have security purposes and metal detectors. Some of us don't like to go in there, but that doesn't stop me from checking on those that we stay connected to.
Tell me about the concerns there with metal detectors and security. What do you mean?
Metal detectors and whatnot, it just triggers some of us out here due to PTSD. Of going in and out of maximum security, as in jail, and other traumatized events.
Do you see people getting heat strokes, suffering from the heat?
Honestly, yeah. I had one myself a couple weeks ago. We're out here all day, and some of us aren't even allowed in the cooling center. But the cooling center, they provide so much information that if we it's our choice to take what they're providing or not. But other than that, it's all on us. Who else can I blame besides us, you know?
Why would you not be allowed in the cooling center?
Due to the fact people are smoking, drinking, weapon-wise, and all that other negativity.
Williams told me she often goes to the cooling center down the street at Grace Lutheran Church, where she can sleep, sometimes watch a movie, and feel safe.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ancraw, and Anna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, the news director. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope you have a great weekend as well, and hope to have you right back here on Monday.